Hello everybody and welcome to the Art Business podcast. Hope you all had a great, relaxed and enjoyable festive season, saw a lot of art. My guest today is an artist, Kojo Marfo, and over the last couple of years I've been involved a little bit with him myself, and he's kindly agreed to come in today to have some conversation with me about what's been happening in his life and artistic life over the last couple of years. So Kojo, I always start with just a few conversational questions, such as, what's your favourite city and why might that be?
I think my favourite city is London. I mean, I love London. I know everything about London. I kind of know everything about London. I love travelling around the city. I enjoy sitting on London buses, the top deck by the window, and I enjoy the views of this wonderful city. So yeah, my favourite city would be London.
That's interesting. And are there any particular buildings in it that you love to look at or go back to?
I enjoy the architectures. I mean, but I really love the buildings around Whitehall. Mm-hmm. And then also from Monument to Shoreditch, those high-rise buildings around there.
That's interesting. So some kind of classic buildings down in Whitehall, very much in that kind of classical style, and then the more modernist works.
Yeah.
That's good. And artists, you'll probably refer to some artists later in the conversation, but if you had to pick like one artist, who at the moment would be someone
dead,
that you think
dead
about?
Or alive, or
let's start with a dead one and then a live one.
For dead ones, I have few. I think I will go for Picasso, and I'll go for Fernand Léger, or how they pronounce it. And then there is this guy from Cuba, Wilfredo Lam.
Interesting.
These three guys.
And why those artists in particular? Do they affect your own artistic style?
They do. I mean, they've had a massive influence in what I do and how I sort of create what I create. And I also like the fact that they created things that are totally different. All three artists are not similar. They all have something different, and they all have a different stories to actually tell the world. So they are three different artists, three different sort of styles, and it kind of suits me, and it helps me to think as well. Somebody like Lam, finding out that he had a Chinese father, African mother, born in Cuba, without basically acknowledging his ancestry, all those things, and finally managed to kind of acknowledge his African ancestry and decided to sort of take ideas from that African ancestry and use it to actually speak to the world. So it's actually, he's an amazing artist. And he's part the best, the only three artists I work to.
And would you kind of identify with him in particular in terms of, being born in one nation and then being kind of quite nomadic? And maybe you could talk a little bit about your own upbringing.
Yeah, I mean, finding out that, his situation was totally different because he obviously decided to acknowledge or embrace his African ancestry after he met Picasso, and Picasso started telling him about stuff that he bought from Africa and he brought from Africa, and those things sort of like gave him a different perspective and a different understanding of his own background. And then so he decided, in a way, to any other ordinary person listening to this program will be like, but why does he need Picasso to tell him about his own background for him to embrace it? But what I also figure out, there are a lot of people out there too who maybe not by their own fault or anything like that, but they were raised in an environment where their ancestry is totally wiped out because they don't talk about it. They don't bring it up in any conversation. So for him to meet someone who is, Picasso, who was at those days like a very huge artist, and I'll call it a star,
Did they meet in Paris?
They met in Paris.
Yeah. So you've got a Spanish artist
meeting a Cuban artist
in Paris. And so those kind of art world centres, cities have changed, haven't they? So it was Paris then maybe New York after World War II. And yeah. would you say London
is pulling all the strings at the moment. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say, going to give credit to New York or Paris or Berlin or any of these places. I will say London. At the moment, for the past almost 15 years, London has become the hub of modern art. I'll call it art in general.
Yes.
It has become a hub. And there are a lot of interesting artists. Every now and then, somebody will pop up. And it's all about, wow, where was this guy? It's just like me, basically. It's like me putting myself in that same category. It's like, where was this guy? Why didn't I know this guy about this guy for a long time and stuff like that? But London has, at the moment, I would say for the past 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have in London here, they have one of the, or England in general, I have to put it that way, rather than narrowing down to London. England in general, they have one of the best artists. I mean, they have Banksy. They have one of the best female artists. Go ahead, name right now. Just escaped me. She's based in Margate.
Tracy Emin.
Tracy Emin.
Yeah, absolutely.
They have this guy who is a very interesting artist. I always call him Hess. Damien Hess.
Yeah.
I mean, in England here, they have one of the best artists actually at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, they may not be anybody's taste, but the reality is these guys are very big and influential artists in the world at the moment.
I think that the YBAs, the Young British Artists, Damien Hirst and Tracy Emin, you've mentioned as two leading ones. They, I mean, in my experience of being a Londoner all my life, you know, you rarely went to look at contemporary art in the 1970s and 80s, unless you were, say, an art student, had a specific interest in that. But people like me who had a general interest in culture, you know, you were kind of put off the shows. It was all very intellectual and introverted, not easy to understand. Obviously, what the YBAs did was almost created a new kind of pop art.
Yeah.
Easy things to look at. Sharps and Formaldehyde, you know, Tracy Emin's Neons and so on. And then the opening of Tate Modern in 2000, that Tony Blair at the time, you know, a lot of younger people were very inspired by what they hoped would be a proper socialist government.
Yeah.
And he had the Cool Britannia movement. And the whole thing in London changed. So suddenly going to contemporary art became really, really buzzy.
It became a big deal. I mean, everyone all of a sudden, I mean, it's not a sudden issue, but it's like from nowhere, everyone became an artist. Nowhere everyone was sort of like energized to become an artist, and it created a very good atmosphere. It also helped a lot of young people who were not academically good, those who couldn't pursue law or medicine or any of these fields that demands a very sort of different understanding of education. Most of them turn into art, because anything that is based on expressing one individual sort of understanding of things is also a very good thing. And since then, things have actually become a very interesting in London here. Anywhere you go, any gallery you go, you find out there's one or two or three UK-based artists in the gallery. So
yes.
It helps. I mean, personally, I would say it's a very good, I mean, England has, London in general has become the hub of art, and it has actually helped a lot of people too.
Yeah.
Because there are so many people out there who wants to express themselves in a different medium, like art or music or any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a time, I mean, maybe your time, they couldn't do that because they were limited.
Absolutely, and all universities, academic ones you were referring to, like someone like myself, if you like, who would be a useless artist because it's just not in my brain to sit there and be able to create music or art, although I love both and I sing in a choir and so on, you know. But I think the opportunities for education, you know, many more universities, many more art colleges open. London's got a number of very important art colleges.
It has, I mean... I'm always one of those guys who kind of complain that art shouldn't be intellectualized, yeah. And art should be based on one's how you feel and how you want to express yourself, either music or painting or sculpting or any of these things. And I still stand by that, because I just feel like the moment you intellectualize it, you remove a lot of people. You kind of like move them out. Mm-hmm. And there was a time that you walk into art gallery and the stories they pull out there or whatever the artist is trying to explain doesn't mean anything to the ordinary person.
That's what I said was my experience in the 80s, you know. I remember even going to like to Kooning at the Serpentine and not really getting it, you know. It seemed very... And the other people there, the whole atmosphere was academic and not inclusive.
It wasn't. And even now, my take on this thing is, I always say my understanding of whatever I am doing is basically to get crash everything and open it up for everyone to actually look at it and see themselves. If I mean, then obviously they could also be part of it and they could also express themselves, not just by painting or sculpting or music, but you could express yourself by doing anything that you feel like you want to do. So far, it's not a crime.
Yeah,
you just have to do it. And
In terms of like the art colleges that we spoke about, I mean, Damien Hirst and the YBAs, they all happened to be at Goldsmiths College of Art in the late 80s. And so there was a whole group of them there for being very creative. But I know that you've been to art college and you in the end you've kind of like dropped out of that, I think, because it hasn't suited you. My question to you, Kojo, because I know your work very, very well, obviously, you know, did the catalogue introduction for your show at JD Mallet that we'll come back to. But one of the things that strikes me is you're technically really, really good. Do you think were you taught those techniques or did you learn them yourself?
I did learn them myself. It got to a point that I just felt like I do not want to take anybody's influence. I've had the influence already, but I didn't want anyone to technically direct me, because the moment they do that, I become just like everyone else.
Yeah.
So I decided that I will actually pursue art by my own means and create things the way I like it.
Yeah.
I mean, most often I do say to people that my intention is not to create a beautiful art. My intention, I don't have any intention of creating a beautiful art at all. What I do is to create something that will actually bring attention. I mean, something that will make somebody stand there and look at it and start thinking like...
Definitely. And the very striking thing about your work, which I think tunes in with what we've been talking about with people like Emin and Hirst, one of the things that they do is create very bold, often highly coloured images that you look, you know, you stop and look at them. And at the moment, I'll say this to the people listening to the podcast, if you're in London, go down to Oxford Circuit, find Flannels, the store, and go there after dark and have a look, because Kojo's images, his many of the portraits, the kinds that he showed in his exhibition last summer, they're staring out of you. And it's really, really eye-catching. And when I went down there for the first time yesterday, I was taking some pictures for my Instagram posts, and there were lots of other young people. I'm not young, but there were young people standing on the side of the road photographing these images. They were really taken in by them. And I think the most important thing to start with about your art, Kojo, and I think that's what makes a lot of artists today more successful, if you like, is that you'd stop and look at them. They're very, very striking.
Yeah,
and maybe we could talk a little bit about your portraits, because all of them are kind of like frontal, and they're staring out at the viewer and they're engaging with the viewer. But maybe you could say something about, we could perhaps talk about where those portraits came from in terms of your upbringing and your different cultural
roots. I try to create things. I mean, I always have this individualistic mentality, like everything I do, I just want to create something that is not connected with anyone. I mean, like I said earlier, I've had my influences. Had these guys who influenced me for me to pick up the paintbrush.
And those influences came from looking in galleries and museums?
Yeah, looking at those images in galleries, museums, and picking up magazines and seeing these images. There are a lot of, I mean, like talking about Picasso and these guys, what I saw there were a lot of images, but their images stood up. Their images were like that, one of those stand-up images that you see it and you just like, wow, why did he do that?
Yeah.
So for me personally, those things influenced me, but then I had to also go start thinking, how can I also create something that will also be part of these classic images? So initially I was sort of painting different painting portraits of people and stuff like that, but then I realized I'm also doing exactly what everyone else is doing. So then I had to change. So when I decided I had to change and create something that will also help me to talk about things I want to talk about, I started kind of researching, going deep into my own culture to actually find out what I could find from that background and use it to also tell my story. So I decided to, whilst I was doing all this sort of searching for images, I stumbled across an image. It was a fertility doll that I stumbled across. So I found that image and I was like, wow.
Is that from Africa?
Yeah, from Ghana.
Yeah.
So when I stumbled across this fertility doll, I was sort of like looking at it. It was simple, just a simple round head with a thing hanging on it. So I was like, okay, this is a very simple sort of thing, which I actually, growing up, I saw it. It was given to women when they reach childbearing age to help them conceive and stuff like that. So,
and well, that's part of the local religion.
Yeah, culture and So it was something that I saw, and then I just felt like, okay, this is something I grew up playing around with it. So why can't I recreate it in my own understanding and use them to communicate about issues?
And that's why the images are so frontal, but they're partly because of that experience of looking at that archaic doll, as it were. You know?
So initially, the idea was those strangers were to use them to actually tell a story about people that I met. Because I always say that if I start painting people, I paint the white person, the black person will ask me, why didn't you paint this? So rather than creating division or trying to kind of pull all representation in, I will actually use these images to create representation of everyone. So then it doesn't look like black, or it doesn't look like white or any other color or Asian or anything like that. So It's just universal. It doesn't look like man or woman or anything that will sort of start any unnecessary conversation. So I decided that whilst I want to talk about people that I have met, the good, the bad, and the ones that I didn't actually get my head around them, I'll rather use those images to actually bring these people, like, bring them to life in a way. They are not life, but like talk about them, but in not in a negative way, but in a positive way, so that everyone also could relate to.
I think because the images are so universal and they're not individualized portraits in any way, it means that us viewers can kind of, you can find yourself projecting yourself into those people, and they project themselves.
It could be part of the strangers. Everyone is a stranger. We are all strangers. We meet each other on the street. We walk past each other on the street. But the truth of the matter is our parents were all strangers at one point. So I just feel like we're all strangers. And the only way to actually highlight the humanity within all these stranger communities is to actually put them all genderless and then let them all look like they don't represent any race or anything. Just like any... anything. It's just like a tree that you walk past. It doesn't have any one representation, doesn't have any sort of connection to one human race or anything like that. It's just there. So I decided that the strangers will be good, so that the stories behind it will actually help people to basically just sit back and think.
Yeah. And there are other layers in those portraits, like the clothing and the jewellery they wear and the architectural settings. As you know, they kind of immediately reminded me of like Renaissance and Baroque art, with their ruffs that look like Tudor ruffs on Elizabethan portraits, and those lovely black and white checkered floors, again looking like Renaissance interiors. Were you kind of aware of that when you were creating those images?
Yeah, those things are part of my observations and experiences. So basically, I brought these things to my work based on my observations and experiences.
Again, going in the National Gallery and seeing these wonderful portraits by Rembrandt and Rubens and Van Dyck.
Correct.
Yeah.
So those things are things, I mean, I've lived in England for a long time, so I just feel like these things are things that I've seen. I mean, you go to any gallery, apart from Tate Modern, any of these galleries in England here, you will always find a very traditional painting out there. And it had a very, I mean, I love them. I mean, I always used to stand there and look at them and question myself and ask questions like, how did these guys do it? What made them do what they did?
And what's fantastic about that, Kojo, is that you're not being taught that in an academy. Mm. You're going to the galleries and you're just sitting or standing in front of these images and looking at them for a long time. I told my students that they must learn to do that. They've been taught to be too intellectual and too theoretical. Go and give the artist a chance. There's a conversation between you and the artist. It should last at least 20 minutes, because we listen to a Mozart symphony for 30 minutes. Why can't we look at a Kojo painting for 20 minutes? It's taken him a long time to paint.
It's really good to actually go to the museums and galleries. And basically, what I do is I don't just look at the photo. I look at those little details and I ask myself, why did they do that? And even though I may not get any answers from anywhere, I start processing it like, maybe this, maybe they did because of that, maybe that. And all this neck rush, I used to watch it and I was, it must be very difficult to put it on. It must be. But then anytime I take a photo and I stand back, I just like the whole thing hanging over there.
It's beautiful,
so
isn't it?
I just thought, whilst I talk about culture and I want to incorporate every culture and every background into whatever I do, why can't I also incorporate this as a representation of the European art that I have seen so many times? So that was the main reason why I incorporated it. Because I knew straight away if I incorporate that, anyone who sees it will see where the idea came from. And so I just thought, right, so then if I want to talk about representation, then this is the best thing to do for representation, to put that thing on, and then anyone who sees it will know the background of where the thing comes from, and then they will look deep and ask me, how, why did you do this? And then that will also lead to another conversation, another background. So there's always me trying to bring different backgrounds.
I think one of the things that's amazing in the images is that those things don't look strange. They don't look particularly strange because those African cultures were using similar kind of jewelry, like very, very large necklaces.
Yep. Yep.
All the listeners will have seen those. And the ruff is actually a very, very similar idea. It's a status symbol to a certain extent. There may be some, it's a beautifully made lace thing. Yep. And as I understand it, the bigger they were, like if you think of Queen Elizabeth, she has that massive one, the richer and more powerful they are. And I think in like African, First Peoples culture, that was also similar. They were status symbols and made of other beautiful and often expensive materials.
It is, because whilst I was researching all these things, trying to get my head around why people do what they do, and then I also stumbled across in Southern Africa, they put a lot of jewelry, like beads.
Yeah.
A lot of beads around their neck.
Yeah.
And I saw that and I was like, okay, this is it. I like that. And then I went, decided to check the culture in East Africa. And again, I saw they put a massive plate, metal plate.
Yeah.
And then I thought, okay, that one ticked.
Yeah, so, and I think I suggested that also reminded me of like ancient Celtic culture. Yeah, they wear the priests, in particular, the druids.
They do that too.
They wear this bronze lunar, they called it a lunar low, which means a
they
little
do.
Moon.
Yeah. They do that too.
Yeah.
And then I went deep into Mongolia and Asia.
Yeah.
And then also I found a lot of things. So I just thought, I mean, what I said to myself is, if I'm going to create art that will be a representation of every human being, then why can't I just take a little bit of symbols from all these places incorporate them in my work? Because the reality is, art shouldn't be centered on one particular area. It shouldn't be for one particular group. And I think artists in general should have the power to actually bring people together. And I feel like if I'm going to be painting, and I've made a conscious decision not to paint people, so if I'm not going to be painting people for one simple reason, because If I decide to paint people, they have to paint every human being on earth for just so that nobody feel like they've been left out. So if I cannot do that, then I have to use these images and then take symbols from every sort of culture, a little symbol from every culture, and put all of them together and then put it out there for everyone to relate to.
Yeah, because and to be honest, I think that's what makes your work so original and so striking and so unique, and yet so simple. I mean, I can't think of any other artist that has used such a gathering of symbols from different cultures across different times. And I think that's why everybody, and London is the perfect place to display
it. It is a perfect place because it's a city where if you walk out from this building, you meet somebody from a different part of the world.
Absolutely.
And I just feel like living in this great melting pot, I have friends from different backgrounds, and I've met acquaintances from different backgrounds. And I just feel like it's a place, the biggest university one could actually have, like go to, is to live in a city like this. And if you're a very open-minded person, you could learn a lot from everyone you meet, because everyone have a different story. Everyone come from a different place with different attitude and everything. So if you learn to live in this, I call it the great melting pot, you will be able to actually live in anywhere in the world and not feel
restricted. There's been a lot of debate since the start of pandemic with lockdowns. You've probably read about people leaving the city of London for the countryside.
They're all coming back again.
And I thought I was kind of often tempted, but I love going out to the countryside, but only for a week. If I'd lived there, I'd go crazy because there's so much stimulation when you get back into London.
Yeah, they're all coming back because they'll find out that it's not... I mean, once you live in London, there's one Australian academic who said, if you fall out with London, something about if you fed up with London or something like that, you're fed up with life.
Well, there's Dr. Johnson, of course, first the 18th century, man who is tired of London, sir, is tired of life.
Yeah,
and it's still true. That was 300 years ago.
Once you live in this city, you get used to it. If you don't get used to it and you leave, then that's fine. You never got used to it.
Yeah.
But once you get sucked into this city, no matter where you come from, once you get sucked into it, you become part of it. So it becomes part of you.
Yeah.
So you can leave. You could prepare your mind and just pack your bag and whatever and leave.
Yeah.
But once you leave, you will still be thinking, must be something happening in London today. Probably missing out.
But also, of course, in the metropolis, there's far more temptations, there's drugs, there's, you know, it'd be very easy to be quite lazy. And Kojo, one of the things I've noticed about you is you work really hard on your paintings. How is that? Has that become almost like an addiction to you to paint? What drives you when you get up in the morning to pick up the brush and paint?
I always say that any man or woman who wakes up in the morning and pick up a paint or and a brush is quite dangerous. Because no normal human being will wake up in the morning and first thing they do is grab a paint and a brush. It's not normal. But the way I work is different because what I do is sometimes I work midnight, sometimes I work in the daytime. It all depends on ideas I have in my mind. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I could wake up and I'll be like, okay, I have this idea going on in my dreams. Let me go and actually tackle it immediately before I lose
ideas. Yeah. It's almost like having a dream and wanting to record it quickly and you forget it otherwise.
Yeah. So the way I work is totally different from the conventional way where artists have, especially those who paint portraits of people, they could do it anytime they like because it's a photo of somebody. You copy in what is in front of you. Yeah. You don't really have to do
anything. It's fairly straightforward, whereas your practice
is imagination.
Yeah.
What I do is based on imagination. So there are times I'll have a very cool idea in my head and there are times where I could imagine something. I mean, sometimes I could take a photo of even shadows. I'll be walking and I'll see some shadows popping out and I'll be like, I like the shape of the shadow. And then I'll take a photo of the shadow and then use it to recreate something to comment on society.
So when this morning I went to the Algerian coffee stores, which is a place I love in Soho where I buy my coffee and tea. And I love walking through Soho. Mm-hmm. And there's so much going on. There's people, different kinds of people to look at. You see quite a lot of poverty as well, quite a lot of homeless people, you know, drug users, obviously. But it's such a vibrant place. But I'm wondering, what eyes is Kojo seeing that world through? When you walk through there, I'm tempted to say as an artist, but that's such a cliche, but how do you see the world when you walk through London?
And it's really funny, and you kind of nailed it perfectly well when you walk down places like that, and which I do hang around there most often. But what I see is...
You said about seeing some shadows and thinking that's a good idea. Is that the way you're looking at
it? I see that, and then I also see human beings.
Mm.
I see human beings in a very different sort of... And I see human beings who are obviously have problems.
Yeah.
And then I see human beings who don't have problems.
Mm. Or you think they don't.
Well, the appearance tells me they don't.
Yeah.
And some appearance also tells me they do.
Yeah.
So, but what I also get from these people is an idea of how we should live.
Mm.
Not how I think we should live, not how humanity should live, because everybody have their own concept of living.
Mm.
But it gives me an idea of how humanity, I think humanity should live.
Mm.
And also those faces gives me an understanding of how a person could be properly beat down.
Mm.
And that by being feeling properly beaten, it sort of reflects on their on their face. And these faces helps me to go home and sit down and reflect.
Mm-hmm.
Reflect on my place in this world and what I think everyone needs to look at and needs to do to actually help create a wonderful world for everyone. But there's also something that I do enjoy when I go to these places, the fact that those people, the drug addicts, those with the mental health issues, those who are just there to peddle drugs, and those who are just there to work, all these three, four, five people have something in common,
mm-hmm.
which is humanity. They all and
I don't know if you noticed that, but like outside Bar Italia and the little cafe on the other side of the road, I think it's a Cafe Nero, there are tables outside and there's a lot of these homeless people begging for money. And it always amazes me, and it makes me smile and feel very warm, because people are very kind. You know, I think if someone comes up when I'm reading a novel, I'm drinking my coffee outside one of those cafes, and if a homeless person comes up and wants money, probably for drugs, I probably get quite angry. But I see people being very humane and kind to these people.
I do
giving them cigarettes and saying, go and spend this on some food.
I do give money. I mean, it may sound a bit wrong for your listeners, but I do give money.
Yeah.
Because I know that £5 or £10 I give to this guy, he won't be able to buy a house for me. He's not going to buy a car. It won't change his life. But then the truth of the matter is, these people, this is a very wealthy country. There is good medical sort of centers, hospitals around this country. There are so many facilities that these people could access to actually...
If they really want
to seek help. So I've kind of moved away from the fact that they're going to be this or I'm helping them to their addiction or anything. I've moved away from that because my little money will not change their life. And the truth is, if they really want to seek help, the guy who's sleeping outside, if he really feel cold and he wants to sleep somewhere warm, he knows there are places that he could access.
Yeah.
And so he is happy in his little world. I may sound like somebody who is glamorizing lifestyles, but I feel like the person is happy in his world. All they need is give him that money, if you can afford it.
Mm.
Let them go and do whatever. Because a lot of us who seems normal, we do a lot of crazy things at home.
We would also spend money on too much booze.
On certain things
we don't need.
Society doesn't actually see.
Yeah.
We don't expose it to the world, but they... decide to expose their habits to the world and sleep rough.
Yeah.
They are happy over there. They don't pay no bills. They have no responsibilities. They don't have to deal with heating or electricity. They're actually happy people.
Yeah.
During the lockdown, I decided to go down Tottenham Court Road. I had some few alcohol in my pocket, in my bag. And then I thought, let me go and have a chat with them because I wanted to hear something. And then I realized that almost all of them have mental health issues.
Yeah.
All of them are happy where they are. They don't want to go and stay in the house because of restrictions.
In your paintings, just thinking about that, your paintings are of what what are apparently, particularly the group paintings, they look like stable, almost like family units, like kinship units. Is that a lot to do with the kind of African culture? Because when I think of this country, one of the things that we do see in this country, by the way, a lot of child poverty, of course, which is sort of often not recognised. You know, Marcus Rashford, the Manchester United football player, he's brought that to our attention big time in the last couple of years. I think the family unit in many ways is broken down in this country. Is that happening in places like Ghana? Because your painting suggests that, and I'm not saying, you know, they are universal, but you seem to have this big thing about a family unit, a group of people who have their babies in their arms and their pets, and they look very solid as a group.
I was raised by a single parent, and it's not something I'm going to hide about it. I was raised by a single mother. We were four, and we're now three. It was like that. So anything I project is basically a projection of my own upbringing.
Sure.
And I come from a very, what they call over here, extended family.
Yeah.
We live in one house. Aunties in this, everyone is like, the whole house
that,
is...
That used to be very common in the UK.
I think apart from the royal family...
it's got less common that grandparents are living in the same house as the children.
I think apart from the royal family, no family in the UK practice that sort of... everyone lives somewhere. So the children's welfare and everything is being taken over by social service.
Yeah.
Because they are the only people who can go into the house and look deep into... how people live. Where back in the days, grandmom could take the child from you, the mother, and then you can go and
work and sort your life out. Yes,
so you don't need the man to support you. The grandmom is already taking that. The man could get out from your life, and then you are actually happy to do your life. But that's how my culture is like.
Yeah,
my culture is basically where if the relationship breaks down, the man doesn't have access to the children.
That's interesting.
The man lose access, so the children becomes the woman's family.
Very matriarchal in Ghana, I believe.
In my family, we believe that the blood of the child belongs to the mother.
To the mother.
So,
which the kind of traditional Western tradition, going back to ancient Greece, it's definitely that the blood comes from the father. That the mother is just a transit to hold the baby.
That's there
in like classical Greek literature, and that's kind of what I guess Western culture bases itself on.
Yeah, based on
very patriarchal.
And ours is more sort of like the mother, the woman called the shots, as they say.
And you can see that in your paintings as well. The women are very powerful people in those paintings. Yeah.
So like one of my paintings that I titled it Dowager. So basically the reason why I titled it Dowager wasn't like Dowager, like the meaning Dowager.
Yeah.
But it was more like my culture. If you marry a woman, you have to give her everything. So and the women are the richest.
Yeah.
So they are the rich. In that relationship, they are the rich.
Yes.
So rather than going to marry a rich man and then the man leaves you this. So I gave the dowager away, but it wasn't like the dowager, like the word dowager, but it was more like she doesn't need a man. She doesn't need anyone.
She's got her own property and her own wealth.
Correct.
The dowager.
Yeah,
so, whereas in this country, a dowager will often be an aristocratic woman who is waiting for the son, the male, to get old enough to become the new duke.
Yeah,
and so you get the dowager who is kind of ruling the family, but only until the boy comes of age.
Yeah, so it's a totally different... But I use the word dowager to kind of... It's a play with... I was trying to play with words. And
with dowry.
Yeah, and I sort of like... Because for us, to marry a woman back in those days, you have to give her everything. Give her a house, give her all that before you marry her. So when the relationship breaks down, you lose everything.
The man loses.
Yeah, the man loses everything. Yeah. The woman keeps everything.
Yes.
There's no, you're not going back. Because you're not even giving it to the woman, you're giving it to the woman's family.
Yeah.
So they've already occupied it.
Yes.
You don't have anything, you're not getting anything back.
Yeah.
And also, you don't get access to the children.
Yeah.
The children goes to the grandparents.
Yes.
So you totally cut out.
Yeah.
You don't have any connection.
Just thinking now about the last couple of years in your life, Kojo, because I think the start of the pandemic for many people was a really negative start. But for a lot of people that I read interviews with and quite a lot of artists, they seem to have They seem to have thrived on the pandemic. So can we go back to that moment when you decided to put in for the competition run by JD Malek Gallery? Yeah. JD and Victoria were my guests on this podcast a few weeks ago, and they were talking about running the gallery. We mentioned you, of course. Yeah. But just to remind our listeners, in 2020, Jean-David Mallet and Victoria Abakaya, who run JD Mallet Gallery in Mayfair, they decided at the start of the pandemic to put on an open competition for artists who were living in the UK. They didn't have to be British. It was an open competition to put in images, send images, and a team of judges, of which I was one. There were people like Simon Dupuri, Gavin Turt, the artist. It was a really wonderful group, a very interesting experience to be with those amazing judges. And we were talking about Kodjo's work, and Kodjo was relatively unknown, I think it's fair to say that.
Yeah.
And it was called Isolation Mastered, and Kodjo's paintings became part of an exhibition of, I think, 25 artists that people could come into at the end of lockdown in the summer of 2020. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that experience?
It was a very... I mean, I always call myself underground legend. I want to be, and I hate actually popping my head up. I want to always be. Yeah. And it was an experience. My then girlfriend saw the adverts on.
Saw an advertisement for the competition.
Yeah, and she asked me if I want to do it,
and I was. And like, you said no.
because I had my little thingy against galleries, and I'm gonna express it here.
Yeah.
Because they put these adverts out there.
Yeah.
Initially, you see just an advert or artist calling, and then you go deeper, and then you find out they're charging money.
Yeah.
For that, I hate to say this, but most often it becomes a scam.
Yeah. Lots of people are paying their £20. Yeah. And there's thousands
of them, and then that gallery makes money.
Yes, yes.
Gallery makes money, and they will probably select somebody that they already know.
Yeah.
So when she showed me, I was like, no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
The language wasn't actually nice for me to actually say it over here, and I was like, no, let them go, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then, and then she was like, I was like, they want my £25, so they could blah, blah, blah. Okay. And then she was like, no, it's free. And I was like, still, I'm not doing that. I'm not taking part in this sort of X Factor business where artists are being paraded like some kind of jokes. But then she did it.
Without you knowing.
Yeah, she did it. And it's really funny because I gave, she took some pictures of her artwork that I wasn't actually interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very strange because those artworks turned out to be very... The ones
that everyone liked.
Yeah.
So it just shows you another person, like your then girlfriend, can see things not that you don't necessarily see.
Yeah, I mean, I was being grumpy sitting at home, not really...
Bit negative.
Yeah, not paying attention to anything. And I was just sitting down. I was going to do an advertisement, video advertisement for money... remittance company, which they promised me money, and then the whole lockdown thing came and I couldn't get
and
the
then
money.
That didn't happen.
So that went deep into my head, and then I had one of these London galleries wanted me to do a group show, and they didn't go through. So I was actually sitting at home relying on my online art sales to make money.
Selling online, which a lot of artists were doing also during COVID, and then more of us were looking at online, and so they were doing very well from that.
Yeah, it was actually going well. So the whole isolation master, isolation master thing was, it was actually amazing. And
What happened? Did they phone you?
So one of the ladies in the gallery called Annie.
Mm-hmm.
Called me to say, hi, blah, blah, blah.
I know, Annie.
You've been selected to take part in Isolation Master. I was like, huh? But then I look at my girlfriend's face. Initially, I was about to go like...
How do you know?
Who are you? But then I just thought, no, let me be very careful. So I look at her face.
Yeah.
And then I go, oh, yeah, thank you. What do you want? That sort of when she gave me the thumbs up, like,
it's them.
And then I was like, okay,
this is your girlfriend, in
she was giving me the thumbs up,
like, said, go for it.
Yeah, he goes, like, it's them, don't say anything, don't say it wasn't you, and don't give them any So I was like, oh, okay, thank you. I sort of like, that's how I responded to Annie on the phone. But I was, it wasn't like I was happy, but it was more like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
But I need to be very, I need to show some kind of sign of excitement. And then after that, I'll find out what went on.
Yeah.
And then she was like, oh, so can you tell us when you could, we could collect the artwork? Yeah. And I was like, yeah, it's here. Do you want me to frame it? What do you want me to do? So after that, I asked my girlfriend, like, what's this? She was like, that's the thing I did. I was like, oh. They said, and then she was like, congratulations. And I was like, I don't know. And then, so basically the whole thing was...
Came out of nothing.
Yeah, I was actually sitting at home being grumpy and thinking... Because the truth is, I don't have a 9-to-5 job.
Yep.
So when this whole lockdown thing came... Initially, I thought it was another holiday for people who work.
Yeah.
I thought, yeah, there we go. They're going to get a long holiday during... Yeah. But then I found out that it affects everyone. It's like everyone stay at home.
Yeah.
That's where sort of reality sort of sets in. It kicked in that, so it's not just people who do 9-to-5.
Yeah.
It's just all of us.
And so how many paintings did they collect from you?
I gave them 2 paintings. Mm.
They came and collected them, couriered.
Yeah, I gave them 2 paintings. I was actually, I didn't get that much excited until I saw the gallery.
Mm.
Because I know where the gallery is, I know Mayfair area, but I've never,
ever seen Jean David Malat?
Yeah, so until I saw the gallery and I was like, oh.
This is in a posh place near Claridge's.
So that's when I was like, oh, okay, all right. Oh, okay, now I don't really, So I kind of like gave up the resistance of not working with the gallery.
And then you were shortlisted. Did they call you and say you've been shortlisted?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
They did.
And
everything just sort of like, from there, everything just went really up. And I mean...
And actually, I can tell you that, A, as you say, Jan Davy didn't charge anyone to enter. And B, the judges, we weren't looking at people we knew.
Yeah, independent.
That's what was wonderful about.
It came to my attention that all the judges sort of like did everything based on independent.
Yeah, we weren't looking for any... You know, there was no discussion of, oh, I know this. You know, there were no declarations of conflicts of interest.
Yeah.
We were looking at artists we
didn't know. I didn't know any of the judges. Yeah. So I personally, everything just happened to me in a way like, who am I? Who are you? Why did they select me? They don't know me. I only sell online in America.
Yeah.
I don't do anything in the UK here. And
then in the show, your paintings, I think that some of Jan David's collectors became interested in them, and he decided there's a lot of interest in this guy. Let's put a solo show on, which was summer of July.
Yeah.
And the title of the show was Dreaming of Identity.
Yeah.
And I had the honour of being asked to write the introduction. And I said, oh, I said, you know my thing, I'll only do it if I like the work. I'll come down and look. And I didn't know whether I was going to like it. And I just, well, you know what I think about the work. It was intriguing because at first I thought, this is amazing. There's something amazing about this. But is there any depth?
And then
I started investigating and thinking and looking. And I began to see lots and lots of different layers of meaning. And luckily, they were ones you agreed with were there. But I love the kind of art I love in like old masters. Like I wrote a piece on Botticelli where I kind of decoded this painting in the National Gallery, reading it on lots of different levels. And so I love that kind of what we call hermeneutic painting, which is filled with secrets that the viewer has to gradually unravel.
And that's my intention too, like to give the viewer the chance to actually engage with them, pick whatever you see that connects with you, take it, because most often you go to art galleries and museums, someone could put a red line on a canvas and they expect you to understand that.
Yeah.
And most often, and that's what people do, they leave the place and they'll be like,
what's that? I don't get that.
Yeah.
My child could have done that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So what I decided to do, I mean, like I explained earlier, to put things, symbols into my work so that people will leave and go like, oh, that reminds me of this. Or that reminds
me of that. It resonates poetically.
Yeah. And then it starts conversation too. So that, what is this kind of thing kicks in. Mm. And then the more they start questioning what that image is about, the more they find something in there that will actually calm them down a little bit, like for them to understand that, look, this guy is not creating what we were expecting, but he has created something that
absolutely
have connection with a lot of things. And
One of the other interesting things that happened, Kodjo, that surprised me was, I think, I don't know whose idea it was, but Jan David's Victoria, they partnered with Aspinalls of London, the sort of luxury designer, and they made silk scarves and handkerchiefs of your paintings.
It was an amazing opportunity. It was an amazing opportunity. So they reached out to the gallery.
They reached out to you?
To the gallery, and then...
because they saw it in the window, thought that would make an amazing, shawl or...
It is still one of the most amazing opportunities at the gallery and Aspinall of London, actually. One of the
so it's kind of co-branded with luxury and your paintings.
Yeah. Initially, I'm always like that. I always have to pause a little bit and ask myself. I was more sort of worried that I may fall into the fashion.
Becoming a kind of flavor of the month and then disappearing.
And then disappear. Yeah. I was a bit more like...
But kind of since then, you've had shows in Miami.
Yeah. We've done a solo show in Miami, which was sold out.
Yeah.
I was in Turkey, which went very well.
That's interesting.
So personally, the year 2020-2021 was an amazing year.
Your life has changed. Well,
artistically, it changed everything, sort of like.
Absolutely.
Those 2 years elevated my status.
Like, yeah.
If I may say so. From an underground painter, wandering around London carrying canvases from East
and tins of beer to have conversations with dropouts.
From East London to South London, going into some what are called dodgy galleries, which they may not see themselves as dodgy, but one of these galleries that you work with and you just don't, there's no confidence in you, and they want you to help them rather than they helping you. I went through all those things and I decided I don't want to work with a gallery. And for me, working with JD Mala has been an eye-opener.
He strikes me, and him and Victoria, I think, they're on the kind, I would say that they're the best example of a commercial contemporary gallery.
Yeah.
So they're producing quality work, but it's really beautiful. It's always stunning what's in their windows. They know how to choose their artists.
They know what they're doing. And I like the fact that you work with a gallery that doesn't ask you to promote yourself.
And they don't mind the promotion. And of course, being a kind of program director of an MA in art business where my students want to learn about that, we don't see that as a bad thing because we think the more art there is and the more good art there is out there for people.
I think they know art. They understand art. Victoria and Jean David.
Yeah.
Personally, I think they understand art. They understand that the artists have a different way of operating.
Yeah.
The artists, it's very hard to control.
Yeah.
Some galleries do.
Yeah.
They will, before, if yeah. I was with any other gallery, before yeah. I come in here to sit down with you, they probably have given me a list of things I need to read from.
Yeah.
So everything is all
they're
set up.
They're controlling you. Yeah. And, yeah.
Everything is all set up. Everything is basically, you will be told what to ask and what not to ask the guy. The artist, you will be told what to say and what not to say.
Yeah.
So by working with them also actually helped me to understand that their style of operating is totally different. They do not put any restrictions on the artist. Because at the end of the day, the art, what they are interested in is the artwork and what the artist is doing, not what he goes out. Obviously, I'm not going to go out and have a fight on the street. I'm not stupid. I'm a grown-up man.
Yeah.
So there are certain things I won't do. But at the same time, they won't restrict you from doing what you want to do outside your artistic premise or whatever they call it.
Yeah. And then most recently, almost a symbol of how your rise, if almost like a rise to fame. You're in Oxford Circus. Like it looks like the old Piccadilly Circus lights with all your portrait images flashing on the sides of that store. It's amazing.
I will credit JD Mallard for actually plugging an artist from nowhere.
Yeah.
And I would say from nowhere. I've been operating underground for a very long time.
I know.
But I will credit them for actually helping me.
Yeah.
There are a lot of artists out there who would love to be in my position.
Yeah.
All I'll say to them is it's not easy being in my position.
No, there's a lot. There is all, like in anyone's life, there's a lot of luck. But you make your luck by working hard.
And, it is a very hard... since I started working with big gallery, also there is a pressure on me.
Sure. absolutely, because you've got to produce work. They say you've got this show coming up.
I have to produce authentic and genuine genuine works. And if it wasn't, I mean, back in the days, I'd do anything. I could just splatter paint on canvas and I just put it up on what's their name's website and
Saatchi or
and then get them to sell it, and somebody will buy it without any. I don't care. I'll be like, oh, let me. I got some loose paint here. Let me just splatter.
I remember once actually, you told me that you kind of, as an artist, when you're working online without an intermediary, without a gallery like Jan TV, you said that it seems to work better the more expensive you make your work. People take it seriously, will pay that money.
I always say to up-and-coming artists that if you want collectors to take you serious, then do not sell any artwork below £1,000.
That's interesting.
Any artist out there who wants to be taken serious, who wants to be a serious artist and not a joke, shouldn't sell artwork below £1,000. What it creates is... Any artwork, anyone who buy artwork for like say £100, £200, the likelihood of that artwork ended up in a skip is very, very high. They'll throw it away when they leave, you know, moving
home. Just decoration.
Yeah, because that money doesn't mean anything. Yeah.
Whereas they're not going to throw it away if it costs them a grand.
Yeah, if you somebody spend £2,000 on the artwork, before they put it in the bin, they will have to look at it and start questioning themselves.
That's interesting.
Why would you spend that much money and then put it in the skip? So when I started, I decided that I don't want to be part of this £500, £50 artist. Because if you make that area your comfort zone, you will never rise. It's like alcoholic who sleeps outside. The moment they make that place a comfort zone, that's it. They're not gonna move anywhere. Sure. They will be rough sleeper all their life.
Yeah.
But the moment you kind of decide to move up, you may not sell a lot, but you will actually sell.
Yeah.
I mean, what I noticed was when I started selling artwork for £10,000, £15,000, I knew straight away that on that place, only one or two people will come in and that would be fine.
Yeah.
And then I realized that when things started selling, like 5,000 going, 8,000 going, I saw a lot of people.
Yeah, and Jan David says that there's like a waiting list for your work now, which is quite remarkable.
A lot of people come in and check my work. Yes, so when I joined Jan David, and then I told them, look, we cannot sell our work for cheap because I do not. Yeah. And they were like, hey, you just work. We know what we're doing. So, and I was like, no, I used to sell art for this and that. They were like, just leave everything with us.
Yeah.
We know what
we do. We understand.
So, to be fair, everything, whatever I've achieved within that short period is all through them.
So they've been very supportive of
their hard work and their support.
What about the future? Because I'm aware that we're coming to the end of this podcast now. Well, are you going to carry on painting in a similar manner, or can't you predict or prophesy how you might change?
But I've made a conscious decision not to paint people. I was actually...
Because you made some sculptures which were amazing, really beautiful.
I mean, sculpture's gonna be around this year. I don't know if I have to disclose it, but I'll leave it here. I was gonna disclose what I have, but we have plans to do a show in America. But we haven't actually set dates, so I don't wanna. But we have.
Are you talking East or West Coast?
It will be in East Coast, New York.
Yeah.
But we haven't actually. Okay. Put any date on it, so I don't want
is
to
this
confuse.
With Jan David?
Yes.
So it'd be like a pop-up? Yeah. A
pop-up show. But in London, I'm working on sculptures, which will be part of the Mayfair sculpture trail or art trail or whatever they call it.
That'd be great.
So if you are in London, if anybody is in London... Yeah.
Are they going to be in public, outdoors?
Yeah, public art. Fantastic. So that will be...
And what materials are you working with?
It will be bronze... sculptures, which
can't wait.
Bronze sculptures, which we will probably be one or two to dot around Mayfair area, but there are also small size, about 60 centimeters size, that will be
been selling in the gallery. That's fantastic.
But in London this year, apart from the sculptures, I'm only working towards a solo show in New York.
Excellent. Well, Kojo, thank you very much for agreeing to be my dear guest today. It's been a fantastic discussion. And I really encourage any of the listeners to to go and look at Kojo's work. If you're in London, I don't know how long the flannels display will be on.
The flannels will end on Sunday.
It's ending 16th. This probably won't be, that will be gone in that case. But
I mean,
keep an eye out for Kojo Martho.
There is a public sort of display on Grape Street down here.
That's right, it's in Grape Street.
Street, in front of the building, Charles Dawes building.
Yeah. The Charles Dawes building in Grape Street.
Yeah, and if you peep through, you could also see the actual artwork, which is about 200 centimeters by 200 in the building. And they've taken a photo and they've used it as a screen by the window as well.
Fantastic.
So that's anyone who wants to see anything. Yep.
And hopefully it won't be long before I can tell people he's got a couple of works in Tate Modern. Or Pompidou, or
MoMA. We're working on that MoMA and all these places.
I'm sure that I don't think it's going to be long. Honestly,
it's not going to be long at all. Yeah. It's not going to be long.
Interesting how it's the collectors and the market that seem to lead the way before the museums get interested?
It's always like that because they are the ones who have to lift everybody up, and then museums pay attention to.
It's interesting, isn't it? A lot of people would think it would be the other way around. I always say to my students, actually, it's the kind of collectors and dealers and artists themselves that create this, and then the museums sit up and take notice.
Collectors always are the main people who uplift artists, and they put the artists on the pedestal because they collect their work. And they are the people who, with their interest and enthusiasm, the artists will get somewhere.
And we're coming back to the beginning of our conversation, Damien Hirst and Tracy M. and Charles Saatchi, you know, private collector.
Yep.
And as I understand it, Damien Hirst was offering works to Nicholas Sorokin Tate, which he was refusing in the 90s. And then suddenly...
Collectors are the main hope, the main, spine of
the dynamic.
The artists. And if they are interested in you, they will build you up.
Absolutely.
If they're not interested in you, then you have to...
They'll abandon you. So let's hope they keep being interested.
We need the galleries, but we need the collectors too. So these two have to go hand in hand. They are the main people that uplift the artists and put artists on their pedestal.
Great. Okay, so thank you very much again, Kojo. And I hope our listeners have enjoyed listening to this conversation with Kojo Martho.